welcome to the Bedazzle Your Elliptical episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance and bedazzling news of the week. This is going to be a crypto episode. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck, also of Axios.
Hello. Hi.
And we have the New York Times' best crypto mind on the case to explain everything to us. Kevin Roos, my former Fusion colleague, welcome to Slate Money.
Thanks for having me. Long time no see.
It's been a minute. How long have you been on the crypto beat?
Well, I've been writing about crypto for like a decade, but I took a little break in there. So I would say pretty intensely since last year when I accidentally sold an NFT for like $500,000.
That's right. You NFT'd a New York Times article. Has it changed hands since then? Do you know what it's worth now?
Well, the price of Ethereum, the cryptocurrency that it was purchased in, has spiked. So I think today it's worth more than $1 million, which I did not get to keep. I gave to charity.
Oh, man.
I know.
New York Times.
We are going to talk to you about the hipster grifters, the latest failed attempt to launder a bunch of Bitcoin. Oh, we're going to talk about your article, which is an amazing article about how Bitcoin can, or crypto can, actually make the world a better place. CZ, we're going to talk about CZ, the richest man in the world, quite possibly, who was putting $200 million into trying to buy a stake in Forbes. It's all coming up on Slate Money, but Kevin, because we love you here on this show, before we get into all of that, please to plug your book.
Thank you. It just came out in paperback a couple days ago. It's called Future Proof: 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. It's about AI and automation and the weird future.
Buy it at your local independent bookstore.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So let's jump in, because I think it's been a minute since we've talked about hipster grifters on this show. And boy, do we have a hipster grifter story. Kevin, on a scale of like one to grifter, where does this land?
Oh, it's off the charts. We've never seen grifter energy like this before. I am frankly obsessed.
With Dutch and Razzle Khan?
Razzle Khan. So, okay. So, Emily, bring us up to speed on who is Razzle Khan and is she a multi-billionaire?
Razzle Khan is Heather Morgan, who is a badass CEO female rapper who's ready to take on Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and any other place that oppresses individual uniqueness and self-expression. Well, that is how she describes herself, but she's also the perpetrator of a big crypto scam, along with her partner, Ilya Liechtenstein, who's called Dutch.
Dutch. We should remember that the hipster grifters are innocent in the eyes of the law. They have not been convicted of anything. They have only been charged. And the one thing I will say about Razzle Khan, like there's a lot of cringe on her socials, but her ability to emulate the winking tongue out emoji is kind of amazing.
So I guess we should say a little bit more, right? They basically got caught in a crypto laundering scheme, the largest financial seizure ever or something, the largest crypto seizure ever.
Like, to read between the lines, they have been charged with trying to launder $4 billion of crypto. It seems that the government doesn't have an open and shut case when it comes to charging them with stealing the $4 billion of crypto. But if you stole $4 billion of crypto, you wouldn't just give it to these guys and let them sit on it for like 5 years. It wasn't worth $4 billion when they stole it. It was worth, like, what, $50 million when they stole it, and then it went up?
I think $70 million, yeah.
And this is one of the very interesting things, is they lived a relatively modest lifestyle in New York. They were in a kind of, like, you know, fair to middling two-bedroom apartment in the financial district. She was, you know, bedazzling her elliptical and upcycling her clothes. And they weren't rich, because the way that Bitcoin works is that it's very traceable, and everyone was keeping an eye on this wallet and saying what's happening, including the FBI. And it turns out that even though everyone thinks of Bitcoin as a great way to launder money, it's quite hard to launder money.
It's really striking, because for a long time, the sort of skeptical talking point about crypto was that it was, like, very good for doing crimes. And I guess for some genre of crimes, that's probably true. It's probably better than fiat currency. But for this specific kind of crime, like taking the proceeds from a giant hack of a crypto exchange and, you know, spending them in a way that doesn't attract the attention of the authorities, it actually seems like they had a pretty hard time with it because of its crypto-ness, because it's like an indelible, you know, ledger on the blockchain. You know, they did successfully launder like a tiny bit of it, but nowhere near the full
They
amount.
Bought like a $500 Walmart gift card. I mean, that was what they managed to successfully do. It was kind of amazing. The complaint goes into details about like five or six different what's known in the crypto world as off-ramps. If you have Bitcoin and you want to convert it into any kind of currency, it needs to go through an off-ramp. You convert your Bitcoin to dollars or whatever. And everyone who does on-ramping or off-ramping needs to go through AML KYC, you know, anti-money laundering, know your customer things. And so they would try and open up these accounts, and these exchanges would do what they have to do under the law, which is like go through the Know Your Customer process saying, who are you? Why do you have all these Bitcoin? Is it legitimate? And they'd be like, oh, shit. And it would fail.
So, I mean, that's what Bitcoin boosters, proponents, I'm sure there's a much cooler word to say, and Kevin will tell me what it is. But that's what they've been saying all along, right? Like
laser eyes.
Yeah, like it's harder to scam with Bitcoin than with dollars. Obviously, if you steal a bunch of dollars, I've seen all the movies, like it's pretty easy. You put them in your suitcase and you start spending them and it's fine. But with Bitcoin, it's far trickier and maybe impossible.
It certainly seems like they had a very hard time with their, you know, presumably ill-gotten gains here, actually converting it into anything useful.
I mean, so this is the big question which I have for you, Kevin, since you actually like cover this stuff. I actually did some reporting this week, weirdly, which is I'm on book leave and I'm not meant to be doing that kind of thing. But I talked I talked to a guy who was like into the whole like criminal underworld thing, and he was like,
"What
guys? If they like had some friends in the Mexican cartels, they could have laundered this no problem. They just didn't know the right people."
Felix, I have so many more questions about your criminal underworld sources.
Yes. Are they a criminal doer or a criminal watcher or a little both?
Maybe a little both.
Kevin.
Wow. Okay. Felix is going to federal prison. Felix is definitely in on some schemes. Maybe he's part of the Razzle Khan syndicate.
It's
mafia?
True. Like Razzle Khan was like, she lived like, you know, what, like half a mile from my apartment. She would just come over with some, you know, Bitcoins on cold storage on USB drives. And I have no idea what I would do with that. Like I am not in with the Mexican criminal underworld, but apparently the Mexican criminal underworld is the people you want to hang out with if you want to launder Bitcoin. This is the not investment advice in like flashing all caps that we failed to give out on Slate Money.
What I'm hearing is if Felix came across some stolen Bitcoin, he would know who to call to launder it and it would be okay. And he would not wind up in an FBI press release.
I know zero Mexican drug lords.
But I feel like you're like 2 degrees separate from them now. That is the thing I've learned so far from this conversation. Kevin's nodding.
I feel like this is a stunt journalism piece waiting to happen. I think you need to try to launder some stolen crypto through the Mexican cartel.
I tried to launder some stolen crypto. What could possibly go wrong? Yes, I think that's a great idea. So the big question I have for you, Kevin, is just this one. Like, is it legitimately difficult to launder Bitcoin?
Yes. Like, I think from what we know, it's like, it is difficult to launder crypto. There are services, there are these things called tumblers that you can basically send crypto to, and it will kind of obscure the origin and like spit it out to a different wallet and sort of make it untraceable. But like, people are watching those services closely in law enforcement, because that's the obvious thing that you would do if you were trying to launder a bunch of crypto. There are also these so-called privacy coins, coins like Monero, that people talk about as being useful for sort of as an off-ramp. So it appears that it is both like legitimately kind of tricky to obscure the sort of source and the flow of crypto assets, but also like, these do not appear to have been criminal masterminds, and I cannot wait for the, like, you know, Ocean's 11 style heist movies that will be coming out based on this whole saga a few years from now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
I really want to talk, Kevin, to you about your piece this week, which was awesome, where you kind of like pulled back on the snark and found a cryptocurrency that is not terrible.
Well, I'll let people judge whether or not it's terrible, but I for years I've been reporting on crypto, and every time, like, the criticism I get back, the thing that skeptics say is like, it's not good for anything. You can't use it for anything. There's nothing that you could do in crypto that you can't do with dollars. Everything is just slower and less efficient and worse. And, you know, they sort of are looking for this kind of use case that so far, like, really hasn't been there in any obvious way. Like, so I've been going in search of just like, what is a useful crypto thing that is like useful for what I call the normie utility test, like, which I think has basically three prongs to it. It's like, first, like, does this crypto thing like solve a problem outside of crypto? Like, you know, there are lots of things that are crypto exchanges or like sort of intra crypto problems that are created by crypto, and then you need to build something to solve that problem. So, but I was looking for stuff that was like outside of crypto. And the second piece is like, does this thing actually require crypto? Could you do it another way? And the third piece is like, is this primarily for financial speculation? Like, is there anything sort of non-speculative about this? And for a long time, I couldn't really find anything that sort of passed that test. And then I came across this thing called Helium, which I don't know how familiar folks are with Helium, but I was not that familiar with it.
It's an inert gas.
Yes, it goes in children's balloons and makes your voice really high. No, Helium is a decentralized wireless network for Internet of Things devices. So that sounds incredibly boring. Let's break that down a little bit. So, you know, there are millions and millions of these kind of so-called Internet of Things devices out there. Everything from like parking meters to connected ovens and refrigerators to like, you know, Lime scooters. You know, they're even, I learned in the course of reporting the story, they now sell internet connected mouse traps that will actually, you know, send you a push alert when your trap catches a mouse. So there are millions of these devices out there and they all need some way to talk to the internet. But it's pretty expensive and kind of clunky to buy an individual cellular data plan for each of those devices. So what Helium tried to do, and it started sort of back in 2013, it's not a new company, but they started trying to build out this kind of wireless network for these devices that could be sort of, that could reach anywhere, that could power these devices, that could allow them all to connect to the internet. And they failed at that. They were not successful. The company was running out of money. And then they kind of hit on this idea as kind of a last-ditch save the company effort to apply sort of crypto economics to their model, to turn these like hotspots, these long-range wireless hotspots that people plug into their routers that powers the network, to have them double as crypto miners and to have them produce this token called HNT, Helium Network Token, that would basically reward people for providing bits of their home Wi-Fi to this network for Internet of Things devices in their neighborhood.
So basically, if I have one of these boxes and I plug it into my internet router and I'm serving up this Wi-Fi network to my neighborhood, and my neighbor buys an internet-connected mousetrap, and the mousetrap sends a ping alert to my neighbor saying, you've just caught a mouse, then, and it goes via the box that is plugged into my router, then I like earn one HNT or whatever for that, and then I can, and the more pings that come through my box, the more HNT I earn, and eventually, if all goes according to plan, the value of the HNT that I earn will pay for the amount of dollars that I needed to spend in fiat currency to buy the box in the first place.
Exactly. So I have a little Helium device that I've been testing for reporting the story. It's about the size of a deck of cards. It sits on my floor right beside me, and it takes some fragment of my unused bandwidth from my home network, and it sort of broadcasts it out to any nearby devices that need to use it. And I get a fraction of an HNT, you know, every day or every other day. And I think so far I've made like $9. Like, it's not a lucrative thing, but if I left it running for long enough, it would eventually pay back the cost of the device and then be pure profit after that. So some people, especially those who got in on it early, made like thousands of dollars a month just by installing these little boxes in their homes and offices.
I guess I still don't really understand, Kevin. I know, like, throughout time, marketers have used incentives to get people to use their products. Like, if you send someone a newsletter, if you refer 10 people to the newsletter, you get free stuff, or Uber pays you to take Ubers because it's trying to get customers, whatever. Kohl's gives me Kohl's bucks. Like, how is this actually different than that? Because it seems like it's just a marketing incentive with like a crypto spin to me.
What was the ex-ante model? Like, how did they persuade people to plug these things in before they pivoted to crypto? Were they giving away the devices and like, yeah, how did it work before?
Well, they were trying to like strike deals with companies to like, you know, install these in your, you know, your offices, or just, they were sort of trying to like bootstrap this network by like going door to door and like asking people if they wanted to like install these little things. And like, it just didn't work. People weren't that into it. They didn't really see the utility in it. And it's kind of a weird esoteric thing, like a wireless network that's not for people, it's for devices. The reason I think this is actually somewhat instructive as sort of a lesson in what crypto economics can do is that essentially it solved, in Helium's case, what's called the cold start problem. So in technology, you have these things called network effects. Like, basically, it's the reason why, like, you don't want to be like the first user of Twitter. Well, I guess you do, because that would mean you're extremely rich now. But like, you being user 100 of a service like Twitter or Facebook or YouTube is not all that valuable, because no one has really showed up yet. It's not really a network yet. But being the millionth user of a service like those is kind of valuable. Like, you get the effects of the network, it's built out, there's stuff to look at and you know, retweet, and there's content. The sort of gains go to the late adopters, if you want to put it that way. But with the crypto model, and what you're trying to build in Helium's case is a network. So if you're the second node on the Helium network, you're not being very useful to people. And a network with only two nodes on it is not very useful for these devices, but a network with hundreds of thousands of nodes is. So then the question is, how do you get from zero to hundreds of thousands? And one way you could do that is you could be Comcast, and you could just spend $1 billion to build, you know, hundreds of thousands of nodes. Or you could go door to door and try to convince people to set these up on their own, which didn't really work for them. They tried that. But what they did with crypto is that they basically incentivized the early users. They basically solved the cold start problem by giving away these tokens. So they would say, you know, if you install 10 of these machines and they're very, very useful, you put them in, you know, high on your roof where they can broadcast good signal and you get a great antenna for them, you are going to make the most money. And so they basically inverted the sort of network model and made the network very useful for people who showed up early. And so that's how they ended up getting this thing to the size that it actually was a viable network.
And the thing that jumped out at me, being, you know, a finance nerd, is that what they're effectively giving away with these tokens is something which looks and smells a little bit like equity. It's something that is a function of the revenues of the company. And in theory, you could tell people, like, you know, if you buy this device and use it, we will give you a certain number of shares if, you know, people use your node. And of course, there are a million SEC-related reasons why that wouldn't work. And you would be issuing securities, and you would have to be a securities issuer, and you'd have to jump through a bunch of hoops, and it would just never get off the ground. And so in a weird way, this feels to me like a little bit of a regulatory arbitrage, that they're taking advantage of the fact that this token is not regulated as a security to be able to do something that just wouldn't be possible if it was regulated as a security.
Yeah, I would say that's partially true. I agree with that. And there's certainly are people at the SEC who think that, you know, tokens like these should be regulated as securities, and that could really blow up the model that Helium has built. And there's other problems with Helium. Like, for example, it definitely violates the terms of service of your internet service provider, who, you know, does not want you reselling slivers of your bandwidth over a long-range Wi-Fi network for smart devices. So one of several problems with the Helium model is that, you know, the regulatory status of these tokens is still uncertain. But I think it's a really useful example of kind of what, you know, people who are into Web3 crypto, you know, whatever you want to call it, see as being sort of the differentiating quality of this, which is that it basically provides another path to achieving a network effect, rather than sort of slow organic growth or spending a lot of money up front. Instead, you, with a traditional network, that you sort of get the users first, and then you figure out how to make money from the users. In this kind of project, the money comes first, and then that money sort of incentivizes people to chase after it and then maybe build something useful in the process. Does that make sense?
I still sort don't of? Really understand, just to be honest. Like, so instead of paying people to use Helium, Helium has them mining crypto and getting money that way.
Well, mining, I think mining is a little bit of a weird word.
I don't understand where that money comes from.
So the money comes from companies like Lime, or the manufacturer of the mousetrap, or basically anyone who's making Internet of Things devices. They pay Helium to be able to use their network. And then correct. Helium turns around. Think of Helium a bit like Spotify, okay. You know. And you're like the artist on Spotify, basically. And so you get you have one stream on Spotify, you get like one HNT in return. And they're just paying out in crypto rather than paying out in dollars.
Why? Why not pay out in dollars? Like, if someone told me, if you use this device, I'll give you $10 a month, I'd be like, okay. But if they told me, like, if you use this device, you have to mine, maybe I'm just old, but like, I'd rather just have the dollars.
No, it's a great question. And I asked the COO of Helium that question. And what he basically said was that there are two things. One is, you know, people, you know, $10 a month is a static number. It's never going to go up. It's never going to go down. Helium can sort of change the, you know, could change the payout at any time. With the token, like, you could make $10 one month and $700 the next month if the token price goes up. So it introduces some volatility that people, you know, some of them might like. Also, it's still not that easy to do what are called micropayments in dollars. So charging someone, you know, or paying someone a fraction of a cent isn't really viable in, you know, in our sort of traditional financial system with, you know, credit card payment processing fees and things like that. So Helium is able to do kind of micropayments in a way that it might not be able to do if it was just, you know, doing this through dollars.
So the question which I have for you is, great, I have my HNT and there is a market in HNT, as you say, it's a cryptocurrency, it's volatile, it goes up and down. People are willing to pay dollars for HNT. So I guess part of that is just people speculating like they would on any cryptocurrency. They think it's going up, so they buy it in the hope that they can sell it at a profit. But is there any fundamental utility to the HNT token? Is there anything I can do with HNT tokens beyond like just try and find a greater fool to sell them for even more dollars than I paid for them?
Yes, because HNT tokens are how you purchase data credits on the network. So if you're Lime, okay. If you're the Mousetrap company, if you're Volvo.
So there's a constant demand for HNT tokens from people, from Mousetrap companies wanting to use the internet.
You basically have to spend this HNT to purchase the ability to use this wireless network.
I think this is clever.
So it's crypto to buy a better mousetrap.
Yeah.
Literally a better mousetrap.
But the thing which I like about this the most actually has nothing to do with crypto. It's just that every time up until now that you've bought any kind of smart device, there has always been an incredibly painful thing where you have to download an app on your phone and connect it to your local Wi-Fi, and it doesn't, it only works and it never connects, and it's a 5G network and that doesn't work, you know, whatever. And suddenly that whole desperate palaver of having to connect your light bulb to your home Wi-Fi, you don't need to do that anymore. It just connects automatically to Helium and everything just becomes easy. Am I right?
In theory, yes.
In theory.
I should say, like, that's one use of this. They're also imagining that this will be used as kind of a roaming network. So if you are like a, you know, cell phone customer and you're going somewhere where your, you know, coverage doesn't, where you don't have coverage, you could, instead of roaming onto another cell carrier's network and paying the roaming fee, you could roam onto the Helium network and pay Helium in Helium tokens to use that network. So they have all kinds of plans that go beyond just like mousetraps and scooters and parking meters. But that's where they've started.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, I think we should talk about Binance. We kind of talked about Bitfinex, not really. Bitfinex was the slightly weird, shadowy company from which the hipster grifters stole their 100,000 Bitcoins back in the day. And it's very big, and it owns this slightly weird, shadowy stablecoin called Tether. And everyone's a little bit unsure what to make of Bitfinex. And then the other really enormous, probably the single biggest crypto company in the world, is this company called Binance, which is based in question mark. No one knows where it's based. We know who owns it. This guy, CZ, who lives in Singapore. He, very friendly chap and very open, happy to talk to anyone, but like it seems to have a, let's say, an arm's length relationship with a lot of regulators. He's like, I want to be regulated. But all the regulators are like, but you're not cooperating. And there are people saying that he's probably the richest person in the world. And now he seems to have done the hashtag billionaire whimsy thing, which is buy a magazine.
Yes.
He bought, well, he didn't fully buy it, but he's going to invest $200 million.
Yeah, he's buying a minority interest in Forbes magazine for $200 million, which none of this makes any sense to me. Number one, why would he want any stake in Forbes magazine? But if you do want a stake in Forbes magazine, don't you want to just buy the thing? Why would you want to buy like a third of it?
There's this intrigue that Sarah Fisher has in Axios today saying, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just saying, isn't that how people do this? Okay, so apparently in late 2020, Binance sued Forbes for defamation over some documents or something, and then the lawsuit went away. And I'm not saying, but that's interesting that they were at odds with each other, and now Binance is sort of coming to Forbes's rescue because it has a SPAC on deck, and like SPACs are bad now. And I guess Binance's money is kind of edging out the money of the other Chinese investment firm that does have money. I'm getting all tied up here because it's so confusing, but the Binance money kind of edges out the Chinese investment firm's money in Forbes ahead of the SPAC, which is weird. I'm running out of steam. I don't understand.
Kevin understands it, so Kevin's going to explain it.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I don't know what the financial rationale of Binance investing $200 million in Forbes is. You'd have to ask CZ. All I know is what he has said publicly, which is, you know, this is a storied media brand and we want, you know, to invest in storied media brands. And he tweeted this sort of cryptic sentence about the deal, saying, invest in both new and old and bridge them with crypto. So it's like, it's possible that what he's trying to do here, what Binance is trying to do here, is just to like basically acquire a stake in a outlet that it hopes will be friendly to crypto and to the kind of Binance business interests. And really, this is like kind of an interesting moment in sort of crypto media. There are these sort of crypto specific outlets. You know, you've got your CoinDesks and you know, such. And generally, they're kind of operating as trade publications, you know, for people in the crypto industry or who already know quite a lot about crypto. But I think there's been a lot of frustration in the crypto community at how they've been covered by the quote unquote mainstream media. Forbes, I would say, is sort of a mainstream publication. It's got this contributor network. It also, you know, has still puts out a magazine. And so there's a universe in which this is sort of the first of many crypto kind of media acquisitions in which companies and very wealthy individuals in crypto try to kind of bend the media more to their liking by taking a financial stake in it. I don't think this is the last media acquisition we will see by a crypto mogul.
I think it's also, I mean, historically, upstart companies, tech startups, they buy a stake in sort of a traditional media company as like a legitimizing move, right? I mean, Binance is a shady company based in who knows where, but now it has this very storied brand it can point to. Forbes, and like, though I think we all have gone to the Forbes website and been horrified, I think some people still feel like this is a legitimate media company. Like someone not in media messaged me and was like, do you know Heather Morgan from Forbes? You know, she's the crypto scammer and is not actually a journalist who works at Forbes. But like to the, you know, to someone not paying that much attention, they're like, Forbes is legit. Oh my gosh, a Forbes reporter.
No, it does still have a brand name, that's for sure. But the interesting thing to your thesis is that when this weird Chinese company called Integrated Whale, I am not making this up, bought Forbes a few years ago, there was zero legitimizing impact on an Integrated Whale.
That's like, true.
No matter what you think of Forbes, no one's like, oh yeah, Integrated Whale, those guys are great, you know?
Yeah, I mean, fine. But there are plenty of other examples where buying a media company buys you a little bit more legitimacy, and it definitely gets you marketing, right? I mean, I guess Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post gave him a great marketing lever to pull, which we talked about, I don't know when that was, a while ago. Mark Benioff buying Time got him a lot of credit. I don't know. It works most of the time, doesn't it?
It's also just like so little money to someone like CZ. I mean, I think we have to like keep in perspective that while $200 million is objectively a big chunk of change, I mean, this is someone who is reportedly worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion, and has gotten that wealthy, you know, very, very quickly, like basically in the last 5 years. And so this is not a huge amount of money to him or to Binance. This is, you know, the equivalent of like one of us, you know, like picking up a nice copy of The New Yorker or something.
And that's true. Like what you often find in the art world is that when an artist strikes it rich, what they do is they start like buying up old masters because they're selling paintings for $1 million. And you can find like really amazing, you know, Dutch portraits from the 17th century for $250,000. And for most people, $250,000 is a crazy amount of money to spend on a painting. But if you are being able to churn out your own paintings for $2 million, then suddenly the arbitrage makes sense. And it, you know, it's almost a little bit like AOL buying Time Warner. You know, it's like he has this currency of which is just worth an insane amount of money. Why not spend it on the kind of toys that you could never normally afford? It makes and plus on top. But I think beyond that kind of billionaire whimsy thing, there is a thesis here in the minds of CZ and the people who believe in crypto, which is that eventually, somehow, it's not going to just be helium that bridges the world between like the real world and crypto. That crypto is going to infiltrate everything in the real world, including media, and that something, something Forbes, something Metaverse, something Web3, we don't entirely understand it, but that there is a way that media is going to become part of the Metaverse, and that if you want to be a force in Web3 and the Metaverse and crypto, then you want to be a force in media as well. And I don't understand that, but like maybe Emily does.
Well, I just thought of something. Remember back in like the 90s and the 2000s, there were Mainstream media did not understand the internet. Remember that? There's that clip they always play where they're on the Today Show and they're like, what is internet? But meanwhile, there were all these journalists, mostly where Kevin is, like working what would become Wired and all these places that did understand the internet, and they won. Like, they eventually infiltrated traditional media. They're everywhere now. Stephen Levy, there's Wired, whatever. Right now, if you look at traditional media's coverage of crypto, it's like, I think it's pretty bad. I don't know. I still don't understand crypto, so that would legitimize what I just said. It is pretty bad. All the mainstream media outlets right now are like scrambling to catch up. And like, if you look at like every traditional outlet, they have like a job listing for a crypto reporter or crypto bureau chief or whatever. Like, they're behind. And so it's time to like do that thing of like integrating. And maybe it's kind of like what Kevin was saying before. And maybe this is like a sign that that's starting to happen, or another sign.
I think it's absolutely important to understand like the scale of crypto wealth and the speed at which it is like moving into every corner of American life. Like, it's not just, you know, Binance buying a stake in Forbes. Like, the LA Lakers play in crypto.com arena now. Like, there are crypto super PACs, there are crypto candidates, the crypto dark money is about to become like a real force in American politics. The amount of wealth that has been generated in the last 5 years from crypto is unfathomable. I mean, the closest thing to compare it to would be like the discovery of oil in the Middle East. Like, it's like that big. And something like half of millennial millionaires have significant cryptocurrency holdings. So like, it's not just the whales like CZ. It's like all these people who have money either from crypto or from something sort of adjacent to crypto, but then have invested it in crypto. Like, they are going to be the next generation of sort of influential, sort of not just tastemakers, but big time donors and media moguls. And like, this mindset is seeping rapidly into every facet of American life, which is why, like, even if you think the whole thing's a scam, I think it's really important to understand crypto. And I would agree with you, Emily, that I don't think the mainstream media's coverage of crypto has been anywhere near sufficient. And I think there's going to be a lot of efforts to correct that. And I hope they work, because I think it's really crucial for people to understand this, even if they're not investing in it themselves, even if they're very skeptical.
Kevin, what do you think is the big thing that crypto people understand that non-crypto people don't understand, that the mainstream media has been doing a bad job of explaining? What is it that, like, yeah, Emily doesn't know, but should know, hey, if she wants to get her brain around this.
Yeah, what well, don't I know?
I think a lot about kind of the psychology of crypto investing, which I think is sort of has some commonalities with like the psychology of meme stocks and sports gambling and all this kind of thing. And I think the media is generally sort of risk averse in its approach to covering the markets. It assumes that like risk is a bad thing. You know, people taking on risks is a bad thing. There's a kind of consumer protection mindset that I think comes from a very genuine place. Like, a lot of people lost a lot of money in the dot-com, you know, collapse in the financial crisis in 2008. I think there's a strain of mainstream media coverage of crypto that assumes that like people don't know what risks they're taking on and they need to be aware. And when you talk to people in crypto or cover crypto, like, they are totally aware. Their eyes are wide open to the risk that they're taking, and they want that risk. Like, I think that is the biggest disconnect. I wrote something last year where I talked about this sort of theory I have about trampolines versus ladders, where like, for a long time, the way to get ahead economically in America was to climb the ladder. It was to, like, you know, go to the right school, get the right job, work your way up, get a raise every year, sock money away in your 401k, you know, retire at a comfortable age. And like, that, for various reasons, that model has like not worked for a while for young people today, especially people who are younger than me, people in their, you know, in their 20s. And so they are looking for trampolines. They are looking for these kind of windfalls, these moments where they can make a big lump sum all at once in order to, say, buy a house in a market where housing costs are rising very, very rapidly, they don't trust that the ladder is there for them. And so they are looking for the things that are risky. They are looking for gambles. They are looking for things that if they pay off, they won't just raise 10%. They'll get, 100% or 1,000% or 10,000% returns on that initial investment. And I think that's a big sort of philosophical disconnect.
That is honestly the nice version of Squid Game, essentially. That is Squid Game.
I mean, there's a reason Squid Game was very popular and seen as like a trenchant portrait of life under, modern capitalism.
I 100% agree with everything that Kevin just said, but the crucial thing that distinguishes crypto from Squid Game, because like a lot of talking heads on CNBC will be like, oh, this is terribly risky, it's all going to end in tears. And the really important difference is that the stakes are so much lower in crypto. If you throw $1,000 into crypto and it becomes $1 million, then you've got $1 million. If you throw $1,000 into crypto and it goes to zero, you've lost $1,000. And if you're in your 20s, you can find another $1,000. And it's, you might technically have spent your entire life savings, but most people in their 20s don't have life savings. It doesn't matter that much. So it's like, why not take the risk?
Totally. I spent a lot of time last year hanging out in like subreddits, the Wall Street Bets and crypto subreddits and things like that. And this one sort of comment sticks with me. There was someone who had just made like a hilariously risky trade and was explaining their decision to YOLO, is what they were calling it, into this trade. And they said like, look, best case scenario, I'm rich. Worst case scenario, I have to live with my parents, but I already live with my parents. So it's like the risk in that person's mind is like totally asymmetric. It's like I gamble and I have money, or I gamble and I lose and I don't have money, but I already kind of don't have money.
I think we should have a numbers round. Emily, what's your number?
My number is 350. That is the number of hours a guy named Alex Patterson at Media Matters spent listening to the Joe Rogan podcast last year.
Wow.
Which is like 4 or 5 episodes of that podcast. Is that right?
Exactly. He put together a report, for Media Matters on like the stuff he heard that was misinformation or whatever. And it was a little part. It was a part of this interesting piece in The Atlantic about how you can't just say whatever you want on podcasts anymore. I'm not advocating that you should say stuff like Joe Rogan says or anything like that. But it was a story about how podcasts are being more closely monitored now as they get bigger, as we see with the Joe Rogan situation. And I was like, oh no, I don't want anyone listening to this. I mean, I want all you guys to listen to it that are listening right now, but like, I don't want to be monitored. That's the fun part of being on the podcast.
For something you said on Slate Money.
Yeah. Like, I don't want someone to tweet, Emily admits not knowing anything about cryptocurrency on Slate Money.
Emily, listen, if here. Someone gets from this podcast gets canceled, it's not going to be you. I promise.
Thank you. I'll put a link to the story in the show notes.
my number is 40. It's 40%. And Emily, maybe you know this. Are you familiar with, if I was to say the word Genie Plus or Lightning Lane, what I was talking about?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. I thought maybe it had to do with inequality, but...
So 40% is the increase in per capita spending at the American Disney theme parks, at Disneyland and Disney World. People who are visiting Disneyland and Disney World are spending 40% more per person than they were in 2019 pre-pandemic.
Why?
Because of Genie Plus and Lightning Lane. They have these new products. They're selling food for more, they're selling drinks for more, they're selling merchandise for more, and they've managed to create ways to get people to pay to jump the line, basically. And it is just, they are minting money. And that is my inflation figure of the week, basically, is that the actual price that people spend when they go to Disneyland or Disney World is up 40% since the pre-pandemic.
Wow. Well, that's fine. That's not like oil and gas inflation. Like, if you want to pay more to go to Disneyland, like, who cares, right? Am I wrong here?
Maybe this is actually the case for the metaverse, is that it's just going to be so much cheaper than going to Disneyland.
And yeah, it was not exactly cheap in 2019, I can assure you.
No. Why? Yeah. Have you been to Disneyland, Felix? I can't see Felix in Disneyland. Can you, Kevin?
I can't. Just riding the teacups.
The teacups. Yes, totally. I just stay on the teacups. I don't go anywhere else. I just enjoy the teacups. That's my speed right there. Kevin, what's your number?
My number is $0.02884.
Is that a cryptocurrency price?
It is. I decided to stick with the crypto theme. That is the current price of something called Smooth Love Potion. Smooth Love Potion is the in-game currency, the in-game cryptocurrency of a video game called Axie Infinity, which is a very popular crypto video game. It's what you get when you play Axie Infinity, and it has soared about 70% in the last day because Axie Infinity updated its game in a way that is going to make these tokens, these Smooth Love Potion tokens, more valuable by reducing the supply of them. And what I find interesting about this, I mean, this is obviously crazy, and the fact that we're talking about something called Smooth Love Potion, but it is this world of kind of play to earn video games that are powered by crypto is really heating up. There are billions of dollars being invested in them. And for a while, Smooth Love Potion was actually seeing more trading action than Ethereum last year. But it basically forces these video game developers to kind of behave like central bankers, like, because they are not only trying to make a game that people want to play and keep it fun for people, but they are also trying to manage the money supply within that game, because this is people's real livelihood. There are people in the Philippines who play Axie Infinity full time as their job and are, you know, undergoing an economic crisis because the price of Smooth Love Potion has been tanking. So this is a big deal in the game of Axie Infinity, and it's going to be fascinating to see how they set up their own Federal Reserve for every video game.
But this is a phenomenon that predates crypto. I remember when people were doing this with QQ tokens. There was this game that, like, a bunch of Chinese play to earn gamers were buying QQ tokens and turning them into renminbi. But I guess it's just like with crypto, everything just becomes, as we said, like a securities arbitrage. And so it just becomes easier to set these things up.
Yeah, I am sort of amazed that Razzle Khan was not in on the Smooth Love Potion grift, because it would seems like a match made in heaven.
Kevin, I want to talk to you about CryptoPunks. We're going to do that in a minute when we have our little Slate Plus segment. But for those of our listeners who don't subscribe to Slate Plus, that is it for us this week. That has been like the most crypto-heavy episode of Slate Money in a while. I'm so glad we had Kevin on to do it, because it's been awesome. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks so much to Shayna Rafter for producing. Thanks so much to all of you guys for writing in, slatemoney@slate.com. And we will be back next week with another Slate Money.